You're listening to Mr. Open Banking, the only podcast dedicated to exploring the open banking movement. Whether you're a financial expert, banking executive, or everyday consumer, open banking affects everyone and will change the way we interact with our money. I'm A.L. Savan, your host. This episode is brought to you by Ozone API, unlocking the power of open finance all over the world. Financial technology, broadly known as fintech, has many faces. Although they often blend together, the different dimensions of fintech each aim to address a particular challenge. And one of the biggest challenges is how to separate banking from banks. Enter embedded finance. Embedded finance aims to weave banking into the very fabric of everyday life, so that it's there whenever you need it and simply disappears when you don't. Imagine a world where financial services are no longer separate, daunting entities, but seamlessly integrated into the digital experiences you already know and love. A world where buying a car, booking a trip, or even just grabbing a coffee means having instant access to personalized financing options, secure payments, and innovative insurance solutions. This is embedded finance, an omnipresent, invisible hand guiding your financial decisions with unprecedented ease and intelligence, heralding a new era where the complexities of financial management dissolve into the background, making banking more accessible, yet more powerful than it has ever been before. If open banking is the how, then embedded finance is the why. Where embedded finance aims to bring banking to people whenever and wherever they need it, open banking ensures that it only does so based on explicit consent, using open standards rather than proprietary methods. Together, these two forces create the foundation upon which the delivery of financial services will be radically reinvented, a transformation which has already begun. All over the world, people have started to bank without banks, a phenomenon our guest has been studying for quite some time. Simon Torrance is the CEO and founder of Embedded Finance and Insurance Strategies, a virtual advisory firm that helps business leaders leverage fintech and insurtech to provide new kinds of value. With more than 25 years of experience helping companies design and adapt to advanced technology, Simon is an expert on new growth strategy, systemic risks, and technology innovation. Most recently, he launched AI Risk, a company that provides research and innovation services to help organizations manage the risks of AI development and deployment. Simon also serves as an advisor, author, keynote speaker, and guest lecturer, regularly collaborating with organizations like the World Economic Forum, Singularity University, MIT, Imperial, and London Business Schools to help leaders across industries use technology to their fullest advantage, especially embedded finance. Simon, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, AL. Looking forward to our discussion.
Let's begin with a basic question. What is embedded finance?
Good question. Essentially, it is financial service organizations collaborating with non-financial service organizations to bring new and innovative solutions to more people than traditional financial institutions. The idea is to leverage the relationships and the trusted frequency of interactions that many non-financial institutions have with end users to help design new types of solutions that can bring greater financial health and wellness to many more people. And in so doing, the end user gets better financial services. The intermediary, the brand, gets an opportunity to deliver more value to the customers, maybe generate more revenues, and to the financial service institutions, whether they're banks or insurance companies or others, it gives them a new channel or route to market through collaborating with non-financial institutions.
So that's the distinction between fintech at large and embedded finance, right? This notion of collaboration.
Exactly that. Nobody, or very few people, get up in the morning and think, I need some insurance, or I am interested in how my loan is performing. So financial services is a bit of a grudge purchase, or it's a bit dull and boring for most people to think about. And yet it's really important in their lives. People are much more interested in what they can do with the financial services. They can buy a car, they can buy a house, they can set up a new business and reduce the risks of running that business, et cetera, et cetera. And so the types of organizations that help people do the, let's say, the fun things in life are not financial institutions. So the notion here is, why don't we collaborate with those organizations that are helping people do the things they're most interested in to design new types of financial services that can serve the needs of those end users in ways that can enhance their everyday life activities. It's that collaboration with organizations that people like to interact with to bring more types of financial solutions to serve unmet needs of those end users.
It sounds like you're implying that people don't like to interact with their banks. Is this fundamentally changing the relationship that people have with their banks?
Yes, I think it will. People trust other brands more than financial institutions to provide financial services. Companies like Amazon, or if you're a driver on Uber, or from your telco, or other types of brands that you know and like better. In the past, it was very difficult for those brands to design and create financial services. But now, due to technology, it's much easier. So there's a really great survey that I saw recently. It was by FICO, the credit bureau. And they asked 2,000 consumers in the US, how do they rate their bank? And they rated them really good. They said 85% said they were pretty good, but only at solving or addressing a tiny fraction of their financial wellness needs. Keeping their money safe is probably the main one. But in terms of all the other types of needs that we have to be financially healthy, planning for the future, understanding how to manage debt and credit, typically traditional financial institutions are not so good at doing that. They're not really helping us to live the most financially well and healthy lives. And as a result, you get these enormous protection gaps, which are already huge and growing fast. Just take the pensions protection gap. That's the gap between what people need when they retire to have a reasonably comfortable life in retirement and what they actually have in place. And that's because they haven't saved in the right way that suits their lifestyle over the course of their lives. And so you get more and more people who are living longer lives, and the danger is that they're going to be significantly challenged in terms of managing through that long retirement period.
These third-party providers then are filling the gap between people's financial needs and the products and services that are available today. Do I have it right?
That is one aspect of it. They are also potentially new distribution channels for existing products as well. If you think about distribution channels for payment services or savings services or bank accounts or insurance, those are distributed either directly by financial institutions or through brokers or through agents or through others. And embedded finance overall is taking a greater share of that distribution over time. So at one level, it's taking share away from other distribution channels for existing products. But on the other side, it is also creating the opportunity to grow the financial service market by creating new innovative solutions that fill these gaps that I mentioned before.
To help crystallize this, can you give us a couple of real-world examples? I think everyone is familiar with payments inside Uber, but what are some others?
So a classic example would be you buy your car and the car company will offer you a loan to lease the car. And at the same time, it could also offer you insurance, and the insurance could be for your car. Others would be large retailers who have set up their own bank or insurance company. So you can buy very traditional financial services in terms of credit cards or insurance from Walmart and elsewhere. Those third-party brands are embedding financial services into their overall proposition to serve their customer base better. But what's now possible is that any company, big or small, can do these types of things at a cost that was just too prohibitive. So you're now seeing particularly software companies that have very close relationships with the end user. Those companies often are providing services that people are using on an all-day basis. If you take the case of small businesses, they've been using software to run their operations, to manage all the activity that they undertake. And because that software is being used day in, day out by small businesses, they generate a huge amount of insights and customer data that they can then take advantage of. We can see that you're growing your business. We can see that you are expanding. We can see you've taken on these extra employees. Maybe you need a loan to help you grow your business. And here's a loan that ties into your particular profile. Or you've taken on these employees. Do you have enough insurance coverage for those employees? So they have these unique insights where they can have this opportunity to take advantage of that very close relationship to make suggestions at just the right time and manner to suit those end users.
In your work, you have started to talk about embedded finance 2.0. What is embedded finance 2.0 and how does it differ from 1.0?
Yeah, so 1.0 would be some of those early examples I gave of the car company offering a loan. The products are not really different to what you could get on the open market. So 2.0 says a number of things. One, it says that this is not just possible through very big brands. It's also your small local bicycle shop. You go in to buy your bicycle. If it's an e-bike, it's quite expensive. You might like a loan for that, and you might like some insurance that is specially designed for e-bikes. And who better to offer you that than the retailer that's selling you the e-bike right at that moment? 2.0 says that now any type of company, big or small, can embed financial services really easily and cost effectively. And second, it says that we can create new types of solutions that are tailored and unique for the customers of a brand. Uber, when it started out, it needed to attract drivers to work for it. And drivers would obviously need special insurance, and Uber needed to offer them insurance to work for them. But of course, these are not employees. And so Uber knocked on the door of insurance companies and they said, well, we sell employee benefits and insurance, but these are not employees, so we don't have products to suit you. The traditional suppliers couldn't address this need, and therefore a whole breed of insurtechs grew up to satisfy that need. So 2.0 says that rather than just distributing existing products through a new channel, we're also creating new types of solutions for end users.
Embedded finance is fundamentally about collaboration. It asks the question, how can banks best collaborate with non-banks to offer financial services in ways that benefit both? Banks, hope to capitalize on the relationships and interactions that non-banks already have, offering them new routes to new markets. Meanwhile, the non-banks can offer financial options to their customers that are simply not possible without a bank under the hood. Win-win. In truth, this has already been going on for decades. Think of a car loan or a department store credit card. But digital has accelerated the pace of this model, so that today it is spreading like wildfire. Simon describes the nature of this disruption and how real it has become. You've done considerable research on the actual metrics surrounding embedded finance. To the skeptics out there who might say, yeah, this is fine in theory, but I don't think this is really going to move the needle on banking fundamentally, what are some of the economic indicators that show you this is actually happening and it's not just theoretical?
I can measure it by the penetration of total revenues by different sectors of embedded finance. So you can already see that in payments, in the US, it's probably about 10% of total payment volumes go through what I would call embedded channels now. Buy now, pay later would be part of that. Apple Pay, Google Pay would be part of that as well. In insurance, it's about 2% of global what's called gross written premiums, which is the total revenues in the insurance industry. That is true today. If you add it up and you look at the revenues of the companies that enable embedded insurance, then you look at the growth rates of those organizations that are enabling embedded finance, and they are growing 3, 4, 5 times faster than the traditional parts of their businesses. That's showing you're in a market which is growing 25% per annum on average, whereas, of course, financial services tracks GDP if you're lucky. So it's taking share from an existing pool that's a very significant amount of revenue already, which is being distributed in a different way, in an embedded way.
Let's try and elaborate on some of the more technical aspects of embedded finance. You have used the term embedded finance operating system. What do you mean by that?
This is the critical piece. I use the word operating system because this market is a digital market. So in a technical world, an operating system is something like Android or iOS or Windows. And it controls the ability for a system to take on applications and innovative solutions and make them available through an interface to an end user. That's what an operating system does. So in the embedded finance world, the operating system is a set of organizations that act as intermediaries. In the past, we're all locked away within individual organizations, we're all proprietary to individual financial institutions. But now, through APIs and other technology, those capabilities, those products, those assets are now abstracted into software, modularized, and through APIs are available in principle to developers around the world who can do clever things with them. And what operating systems do is they act as the intermediary between those components. We could see them like Lego bricks, lots and lots of Lego bricks that exist now, but on their own, they're quite useless. An operating system helps developers who work for non-financial institutions to take those Lego bricks and configure them in ways that serve their customers and integrate them with their own systems. So the operating system enables that, and offered as a managed service to the brands, big and small, it takes away all the complexity of accessing those Lego bricks, those components, and provides the workflow tools that help developers make sense of them and use them and deploy them. If I just bring that to life with some examples, Stripe would be an operating system. So Stripe makes it easy for my tiny company to design payment services that suit my customers. It also gives me access to loans now as well. And it takes away all the technical complexity of that. Other types of operating systems, some people call them bank as a service platforms or embedded insurance platforms, enable brands, big and small, to create lending or banking or insurance programs. So the operating system is a really key control point in the market because it sits between the demand side, the third-party brands and their customers, and the supply side, which is the components that are needed to do embedded finance. And it makes it easy for those parties to interact. If you are the operating system, you are in a very, very powerful position. And that's why some banks have tried to play that role. A lot of startups have probably been more successful. And the banks now are starting to think, rather than just being on the supply side, providing components or capabilities or products into the system, they need to reconsider their role in the value chain, in the value stack. And increasingly, they're thinking we need to create these operating systems and coordinate supply for brands rather than being left on the supply side.
You just used the term value stack. What do you mean by that?
Value stack is another software term. You can think about it as like a value chain, but stack is the way that technologists talk about markets because there are foundational elements that build on top of each other. In this particular case, let's start at the bottom on the supply side. On the bottom will be these Lego bricks, these components of financial services, whether they are individual products, their capabilities like balance sheet or know your customer, or their risk tools. At the bottom, that's the supply side. You can also put regulatory licenses down there as well. These capabilities that in the past were just locked away within individual financial institutions. Then above that is what I call the operating systems. They manifest themselves as businesses that provide managed services. So these operating systems that take the supply side elements, and then above them are the brands, the non-financial brands that want to do embedded finance. Inside those brands, you could also break down the stack there. So they have their systems in which the financial services need to be integrated. They would have access to customer data to be able to design products and price products effectively. At the top end of their stack would be the interfaces that they have with their end users. And those interfaces, of course, could be a mobile app, a website, it could be a physical branch, it could be a call center. And then above the brand, you have the end users, myself, yourself, small businesses, etc. You could also add the notion of risk at the very top. So as I go about my life, I have various things that is risky. I don't have enough money. I don't have coverage. I don't have enough retirement savings. Financial services is addressing those risks to my happy lifestyle. And that, what I've just described, is the value stack. Why it's important, particularly for incumbent organizations, is to work out where they play along that stack. So they could decide, we're going to be just brilliant at exposing our capabilities and other people can use them. That might be a great strategy for some organizations. It could be that, no, hold on, we could be commoditized there. We want to play the role of the operating system. We want to be enabling brands to use financial services, and we want to coordinate not only our own products and services, but also those of others. That's where you see banks and insurance companies creating their own embedded finance or insurance propositions. Equally, those incumbents, they are also themselves brands, and they serve end users. And they themselves could use embedded finance operating systems to be able to ingest other types of solutions which are complementary to their own from third parties. So rather than them trying to create the latest innovative solution themselves, they can also ingest them, just like a non-financial brand can ingest clever financial solutions. They can do the same, and they might decide that's a good position to retain that end user relationship. And that's where you get the notion of ecosystems and marketplaces that insurers and banks are looking to create.
To survive in the world of embedded finance, banks are going to have to learn how to operate without the benefit of a walled garden. Gone are the days when people will come to a bank when they need banking. Instead, banks must meet people wherever they are as they live their lives. After all, a bank customer can now be anywhere doing anything. And wherever they may be, they expect their bank to be there if they need them, and to leave them alone when they don't. The banks and other fintech providers who can do this successfully will become a seamless part of their customers' digital lives. The ones who cannot will not survive. Thankfully, open banking compels them to move in the right direction by providing open standards that ensure participation in the digital economy happens on a level playing field. Embedded finance could not ask for a better friend. Let's bring this home to open banking. How do you see the relationship between embedded finance and open banking?
Yes, well, it's a key enabler of it. So my data was all locked up in banks before. It's very valuable data. If I can make it available to an innovator who is trying to create new types of services that suit me specifically, then of course it's very valuable for that innovator. It's very valuable for me. It's part of a broader movement of open finance and the broader movement of open data in general. Financial services has always suffered from opacity. We don't quite know enough about our end users. But if you can combine open banking data with other types of data, then you can understand people's needs much better, and you can create solutions that can address those needs much more effectively. So it's a really critical enabler, and ultimately, it then helps to address the fundamental problem I mentioned at the beginning of our talk, which is trying to close the gap between what people need to be financially healthy and well, and what the industry today is able to deliver at a profit. That gap has been pretty wide for a long time, and it hasn't really changed over many decades. Open banking can help to close that gap.
And crucially, to do so across the entire economy. So in the same way embedded finance unbundles financial services and makes it possible to embed them in non-financial interactions, open data provides data from all of those sectors to enhance and empower those experiences. Is that right?
Absolutely. I had a great example of one of my customers in Mexico, actually, that it's a bank there, and they set up a embedded finance operation. And they had a relationship with the biggest telco there. They wanted to offer loans to telco customers who are underserved. And they found that they got 200 new data points from the telco that augmented their 5 data points that they had as a bank. You've got your 5 data points that the bank has to try and make decisions about who to target and what the risk profiles are, what the price should be. And then you add 200 different data points related to location of people, where they move, the credit history they've had with the telco as well. That's very powerful, exactly as you say.
Beyond open banking, there's two other developments you often highlight as crucial parts of the puzzle. Let's talk about the rise of real-time payments and agentic AI. How do you see those two pieces fitting in? Let's start with real-time payments.
For me, it's a piece of friction in the market, which slows down innovation. Payments and financial services are the lubricants to innovation and trade and getting what you want. And so all that friction, it just slows down innovation. There's a lot of unnecessary cost caused by technical friction. So real-time payments make it easier for goods and services and other sources of value to be traded and transacted. That just helps the whole system.
Now let's move to agentic AI. What do you mean by agentic, and what role will it play?
Mustafa Suleiman was the founder of DeepMind. And DeepMind, as you remember, created the AI system that beat grandmasters at chess some time ago. He's now the head of AI for Microsoft. He's one of the leaders in AI, and he has this notion of a new type of Turing test. You give an AI system $100,000 and you say to it, turn it into $1 million. And your task is to invent a product that serves an unmet need, to source all the materials to create the product, organize the manufacturing of that product, sell the product on, let's say, Amazon, and then make $1 million by X date. Those complex set of tasks are what he calls artificial capable intelligence. So this is the next iteration of AI. That's what agentic AI means. You have agents, just as you have in financial services, by the way, agents that act on your behalf. You tell them, can you find me a mortgage or can you find me some insurance for this sort of price and for this purpose? And the artificial agent goes out and sorts it out by interacting with other systems and other AI robots. It is undertaking complex end-to-end tasks to your requirement. That capability is potentially very disruptive. It's deemed possible in maybe the next 3 years, versions of what I've just described. If you combine it with masses of data, not just open banking data, but other sources of data, plus real-time payments to lubricate the whole system, then that is very disruptive. It's also very exciting in terms of helping to address some of the challenges that we have around democratizing and enabling financial wellness.
Put a bow around that for us. How do agentic AI, real-time payments, and embedded finance all work together?
So let's say my phone is on my desk right now. I pick up my phone and I say, Siri, please define for me a way whereby I can retire comfortably in 10 years' time based on this type of income that I feel I need and the assets that I currently have and the trends in the financial markets. Please come up with three different options that can optimize my existing retirement savings plans and potentially double or treble the amount of available capital that I have based on who I am, how the market might evolve, and my potential health situation. What I've just described could be a scenario in the not too distant future. All those different sources of data, the agents working to come up with different solutions for me. Once it delivers me those options, I could ask it to describe the risk profiles of those different scenarios. And I could ask it to then organize scenario one, because I like it the best, and make it happen for me. And that is all done through me talking to Siri through my phone.
So a kind of AI-driven financial co-pilot that's going to manage my finances and indeed my life for me.
Yes.
To close, let's look to the future. Let's imagine that everyone has one of these AI co-pilots. What does banking look like? Does it become completely invisible, or is it still part of our lives?
I think it becomes increasingly invisible, really. I have not walked into a branch for 30 years. Trends are going to fundamentally impact the business model of banks, which has been based on opacity and transactional friction. So once those moats disappear, then traditional banks will disappear unless they can work out where to play and how to win in this new world. So banking, keeping my money safe, financial advice, insurance, access to money, the ability to transfer it and make money from money. All of those things are still needed by everybody as we go about our daily lives. But whether banks will provide them is open to question.
Simon, where can our guests find out more about you and the work you're doing?
I've got two websites, one called embedded-finance.io. A lot of my material is there. I created a new business called AI Risk, which is about helping companies work out the risk of either not deploying AI or deploying AI in the wrong way. There's a website called ai-risk.co, but the best way of connecting is through LinkedIn. So I publish all my materials and my thoughts there. That's probably the best place to keep in touch.
Thank you for a wonderful conversation. It's been great.
My pleasure. I've really enjoyed it as well. Thank you, AR.
Way back in 1994, Bill Gates gave us what is perhaps the single most iconic quote about banking and technology ever. Banking is necessary. Banks are not. This year, that quote is 30 years old. What Bill Gates understood 30 years ago is starting to become plainly obvious. The fact is, people don't like their banks all that much. They may need their bank and trust their bank, but banking doesn't exactly represent the most fun part of their lives. In a perfect world, people prefer their banking to be invisible, but ever present. Like the air they breathe, they want to forget that it's there, but rest assured that it will always be there. Reliable, but ambient. Technology now affords us the ability to deliver banking in just such a way. Embedded finance and the technologies surrounding it mean that banking can be offered anywhere, by anyone. Not only does this increase the size of the pie for banks and non-banks alike, it also improves the financial wellness of their customers, and as a result, of society at large. Paired with open banking, real-time payments, and agentic AI, embedded finance promises to tear down the walls between commerce and finance, finally filling the gap between financial needs and financial services. The banking that is necessary without the banks that are not. Thanks for listening to Mr. Open Banking, the podcast that explores the ongoing evolution of open banking and its impact on our lives. Make no mistake, the rise of open banking is going to change financial services forever, and we will be covering that story every step of the way. This is your host, A.L. Savan. Until next time. This episode of Mr. Open Banking was made possible by Ozone API, providers of the only API platform that supports every open banking standard in the world, unlocking the power of open finance. To learn more, visit ozoneapi.com.